Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here on New Books East European Studies, New Books Jewish Studies, New Books History, today with my guest, Professor Eliza Ablavatsky, who is the author of Revolution and Political Violence in Central Europe, The Deluge of 1919, published just out by Cambridge University Press 2021, as part of its series, Studies in the Social and Cultural History of Modern Warfare. Thank you so much, Eliza, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. This is very exciting.
So we have so much to talk about, and I want to offer a brief introduction of Professor Eliza Ablavatsky. She is Associate Professor of History at Kenyon College in Ohio, where she has just completed her term as chair, condolences, of the history department. And the first book, Revolution and Political Violence in Central Europe, this is her first monograph. She's previously been the co-author of several books on the Jews of Chernivtsi, or Chernivtsi in Ukraine, published in German. Dr. Ablavatsky has published articles and chapters on gender, revolution, and anti-Semitism. And we'll talk about her current project on refugees in Eastern Europe, East European Jewish refugees, toward the end of our broadcast today. So I'd like to start with the first big question that I love to ask historians. It is somewhat autobiographical, but I would love to ask you what motivated you into this topic.
Well, as you can probably tell from reading my book, I am a believer that autobiography is very important in understanding people's beliefs and their perceptions of the world. So I think that I just have found on multiple occasions, and you know, now with some time and reflection, I even feel like it might be a generational question of sort of going to college and graduate school in this immediate kind of post-1989 world of transition in Eastern Europe that got me probably interested in these questions about how people sort of live through these world historical transitions. And I have always loved the study of the First World War and the early 20th century, and I love the art and the music and the everything. So I sort of was just inspired to kind of figure out what was it like to, you know, live through these revolutions and then their failure, and then to have to kind of live with the question of like what had happened, like what had you just experienced, despite being in rural Ohio for my professional life, I do love being in cities, and I find that cities in particular are places where there's just such a rich field of interactions, and that people's lives are woven into all of the kind of structures and institutions in those urban spaces, that it kind of, this seemed to sort of lay itself in front of me, this question of these failed 1919 revolutions.
And I was thinking a lot about your cities of choice, and I guess in comparison and contrast to the boom in populations, really, I would say up to the 1910 census and on the eve of World War I. So which are your cities and how did you come to choose them?
That's a very good question. So, as I said, they seem to present themselves. And then obviously the the obviousness of that choice is one with hindsight, right? Because, I mean, there was a attempted revolution in Finland, and I don't speak Finnish, and, did not, right? For years, Volker Berghahn kept insisting to me that the best comparison was a triangle and that I really needed to include Vienna. And I love Vienna, and Vienna is an important sort of sideshow in the story that I am telling, in that people are fleeing to there and from there. And it makes a great comparison, both in terms of thinking about the development of these two cities and then also in thinking about that post-war moment. But I never felt that three-legged stool of like a full-fledged comparison was going to work, in part because in comparison to Vienna, Munich and Budapest are just so similar. And a comparison is very hard to structure to begin with. I actually spent a couple of years in Berlin at the Center for Comparative History under Jürgen Kocka, and I also, there are all these sort of theories about how to structure comparisons. And the two cities in the end that I had, they're both events that are happening overlappingly. They're not entirely simultaneous, but they overlap and are simultaneous and they're sort of feeding into each other. And I just felt like focusing on those two places rather than including like Spartacus in Berlin or Vienna with the, that it just seemed that they were sort of almost in one way a singular phenomenon that of course needs to be unpacked into its local differences.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I really like that hook that you start with, the Tale of Two Cities and Dickens. And I think it works. And it made me think a lot about the history of 1919. I mean, I am interested in 1919 as a kind of diplomatic moment in the Paris Peace Conference, what's happening out there in the world. I wonder what 1919 means to you as a centerpiece for your book. And in many of your chapter titles, you have the idea of world revolution. So, or deluge in the title of the book. So what is 1919, I guess, for you? This is kind of like the master narrative, master script question. What is the impact and what happened in 1919?
Well, I think, again, to revert to autobiography, I apparently have been obsessed with 1919 for quite some time. My undergrad honors thesis was actually on the plebiscite in Upper Silesia. And I, at the time, not reading Polish and having undergrad level German, but trying my best with some German sources, I ended up using lots of those Carnegie peace documents, right? So all of these translated documents having to do with the Paris Peace Conference. And I read the foreign relations papers of the US at the time. And I think that just this idea that you can look at it from all of these perspectives, and people have framed it from all of these perspectives, right? Either with admiration for this like crowd of gray-haired men assembled in Paris who are going to rewrite the maps, right? Your heroes, the experts, with all of the criticisms that can come with that, and the other perspective from a kind of autobiographical framing is that while I was a graduate student at Columbia, I took a lot of classes with Mark von Hagen and was introduced to the really amazing scholarship on the Soviet Union. And I was just taken with, you know, sort of in particular Sheila Fitzpatrick and then, you know, people who followed after her and this whole school of kind of looking at people, kind of this process of like making yourself Soviet, right?
Right.
And that really struck me as ringing very true for all kinds of situations. And it's funny because I was at a conference and I even invited Sheila Fitzpatrick to speak at Kenyon. She really was an inspiration to me and her work for my work. And when I told her the first time that I found, you know, I thought what I was doing for 1919 in Munich and Budapest was, you know, like in her direction. And she was like, oh, but those revolutions failed. and you know, basically, you know, with the argument essentially that, like, you know, there weren't this kind of institutions with which people could, you know, create themselves, but I don't know, in a more like Ilfin Petrov kind of 12 chair sense, like, I feel like you don't really need institutions. Like, people are writing these narratives for themselves all the time. And that it actually informs how the revolutions unfold and the counter-revolutions. So that was kind of the other direction that I was coming from, was this like Soviet historiography about creating the new Soviet person and creating this new state. And so I felt like this idea of world revolution, both in the theoretical sense as proposed by the Bolsheviks themselves, but also, you know, in the sense of all of the debates afterwards on the failure of that project,
yeah.
Right? Which tended to focus on, you know, failings of individual communist leaders, or the, you know, stabs in the back from the socialists, or the, you know, that it was a very political history. And I sort of wanted to do for it what had been done, I felt, for the Soviet Union itself, which was to populate it with real people rather than just politicians and their political works.
And that, Eliza, is really my next question for you, because as a high practicing social historian, I love the fact that you're including so many sources from memoirs and introducing a lot of characters who have roles, I would say, that are somewhat ambivalent, or maybe ambiguous would be the better word. Could you introduce through your sources to our listeners here at New Books Network some of the characters and how you seized upon the sources? I mean, what you ended up doing in combining this into both social and urban and I would say intersectional history as well?
So I went and perhaps ended up embodying a warning that I had gotten from Victoria de Grazia to my first proposals for dissertation fellowships, which is, she's like, are you going to walk barefoot and ignorant into the archives? and I, you know, I didn't actually have, before I went to either Munich or Budapest, a good sense of what was available in the archives. And I maybe went with some high hopes that were not, you know, as you know, there are some amazing finds in the archive that you did not expect. But there also is, you know, a kind of, sometimes it's hard to figure out how to work with what is available. And as you see in my book, one of the places where I found answers to the questions that I was looking for, this question of sort of how did ordinary people behave? How did they explain their actions? How did they see the things that happened to them and the things that they had done as fitting into a broader narrative? The place where I found in the archives the richest information about that really was in terms of criminal justice. And that had to do with these post-revolutionary trials, which in both cases was, I would say, the kind of richest single archival source that I was able to work with. So in both places, the defeat of the revolution led inevitably to all kinds of arrests, criminal investigations, and then eventually trials. The record for those post-revolutionary trials was very complete in Munich. There was a special court that was established, and the entire record of that court is available. In Budapest, the cases were handled by sort of, I would say, like juiced up versions of the previous courts. They were handled more quickly and they added more judges to certain kinds of cases.
Sorry, Eliza, can you just go back and say the cases were handled?
So in Budapest, the cases were handled by, I almost would call it a kind of enhanced or juiced up version of the normal criminal justice system. So there were cases having to do with revolutionary activities were fast-tracked, and there were additional judges added to make these sort of trios of judges for certain kinds of cases. First of all, it was more dispersed, and also not all of those cases were available. The appeals were more reliably available, and in the appeals files, I was able to see the original court cases. So in both cities, that criminal justice aspect. And it was very interesting to me also because the court itself, you know, as we all love to watch these like court procedurals, like the law carries with it all of these narrative forms and structures. And so seeing the ways in which these idealistic political narratives were sort of fit into this legal structure was also in and of itself quite interesting. And I also really relished the fact that some of the activities described in these court cases were really things that otherwise you have no record of, right? Like disagreements over the political happenings in people's apartment courtyards or in train compartments, and actually people turning other people in for things they said on trains seems to have been a common theme in both cities. And I wonder if also that kind of enforced intimacy of a train compartment, you might have quite deep conversations depending on the length of the train ride, but in the end you don't really know the person and you don't have a lot invested in them, and so maybe those are people who are pretty willing to turn you in.
And actually that was a big question that I had is reading in reading your chapters about the trials. I mean, to our listeners also, I should say you have 6 chapters. So the first chapter is Central European Roots of Revolution. The second is World War and World Revolution. The third is, I love this chapter, On Rumor and Terror, Revolutionary Script and Political Violence. The fourth is Revolution on Trial. The fifth is Seeing Red. Another chapter I love, Dangerous Women and Jewish Bolshevism. And the sixth, Remembering the World Revolution, followed by conclusion. So I really wanted to ask you a lot of questions about the trials because, I mean, how do you then go about identifying people politically? There's obviously this, you know, sort of insane obsession in both Hungary and in Munich at this time with people who might be deviant or anarchist or communist Jewish or whatever. Are you able, you know, despite not being able to identify a lot of the characters, to sort of read between the lines? Is that important to you? And how did you go about doing that?
Yeah, I that was sort of one of the questions that I had, because the question of how people come to the attention of the authorities is obviously the beginning of this criminal justice narrative. So some people are obviously known quantities, right? They were figures in these governments or institutions, or they were very public figures who wrote publicly in support of the revolutionary governments. And then there were people who were obvious in, not to us as historians, but obvious at the time because they were on lists. They had,
exactly.
Right, they had picked up arms to participate in the Red Army, or they had, participated in some other way for which the new counter-revolutionary authorities had a written record. One of the very interesting things I found in looking through people's police files, and so the police are, in some ways, the beginning of the criminal justice story. And in both places, also, there was the military sort of served that policing function initially, much more so in Munich, where there was this kind of official sort of military occupation, followed by turning over to civil authorities. But this police function of sort of receiving denunciations and investigating some of these claims. And one very interesting thing I found, which I sort of touch on in various places, in particular in the chapters that you were highlighting, the chapter on the terror, because that relies a lot on court cases for some of my information about it, and then the chapter on the cases themselves, and then chapter 5, as you talked about, the one that where I focus in on gender and race, that chapter also relies a lot on mostly sort of analyzing these court cases. And one interesting thing which sort of spans all three is that in both places, the uncertainty is just highlighted by the fact that there were so many cases of mistaken identity.
That's a great point.
That a lot of people have, as they do here, and we know from the internet, right? I mean, you try and sign up for an email address and all of the versions of your name are taken, right? So lots of people have the same or very similar names. In this era, that really was sort of all the information that they had. And so there's all kinds of crazy cases where someone comes up for court case over acts that they did commit or are accused of committing, but they only came to the attention of the authorities, not because of what they had done, but because they shared a name with someone famous. So I use in my discussion of one of the major acts of Red Terror that was used, the so-called murder of hostages in Munich, and that case against the people who killed those so-called hostages, who killed these prisoners that had been taken by the Red government, that court case, pulled in all kinds of information. And I use that one baker's assistant who just, pulled in basically because he shares a name with the guy who is accused of ordering the shooting at the gymnasium. So there's a lot of people also in Hungary. There are several people who were either pulled in by the Reds for these revolutionary courts, or who were pulled in afterwards because of confusion over their last names, And I think that sort of shows a little bit just both we sort of want to know like what really happened, but of course the authorities were working in kind of a fog, and they did not have they didn't have GPS tracking on people's smartphones, and they really were just trying to figure out, is this the Zeidel who we're looking for?
Yeah, and it's a horrible coincidence then for people who are actually innocent, right? And then have to face this revolutionary justice or counter-revolutionary justice after the fact.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini,
and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I wonder if I could ask you about the contextualization of feminism and anti-feminism in the book. I think this is such an important gender analysis of revolution and counter-revolution, but it's told in a very intimate way where you're getting, as I think Maureen Healy does and Nancy Wingfield as well, I mean, into the intimate histories and stories of violence. I wonder if you can talk about that. And I think the anti-feminist sort of justice or meeting out of justice eventually, of course, becomes part of the counter-revolutionary regime. But I mean, how do you structure the stories and micro stories in the book?
So, you know, it is true that counter-revolutionary narrative becomes so much more dominant, both in those societies, but also, you know, in my own work. I actually, like, one of the reasons I am enjoying my turn now to this refugee question is I'm sort of tired of these right wingers dominating my field of vision with all of their with all of their fantasies in that era. I think that my thought was, as I said, you know, I just had this idea of trying to figure out, like, how revolution made people rethink their lives, you know. And I always, when I'm teaching either Russian and Soviet history or when I'm teaching just the, like, modern Europe survey, I love to have students read, like, August Bebel or Alexandra Kollontai, you know, all of these kind of, like, communist fantasy and socialist fantasies of how communism will solve these inequalities and struggles of daily life, right? And in particular, how it will rewrite the role of women in society. We will no longer have to cook our meals in individual kitchens, and we won't be tied to these repressive structures. And, you know, and then the terror that vision really seems to have been one of these places where the terror of revolution really set in. And that's, you know, from the French Revolution on, this idea that revolution was going to tear apart the cloth of society, that it was going to rip apart the family, and, you know, that it was unnatural. And women obviously are the center of this terror of revolutions being unnatural, that women might behave in unnatural ways, or they might, you know, they might no longer produce families. And and I was interested in both sides of that, in trying to also get a sense of, like, what was it like to be a young woman in this moment where maybe the world was going to get rewritten, right? Maybe you don't have to step into those same roles. And the best source that I found, it was really wonderful, that Ketzler, Gabriela Ketzler, is the mother, and then one of her foster children, she had run a children's home outside of Munich, and one of her now adult but foster children, Hilda Kramer, was also tried in these post-revolutionary trials. And the Ketzler had two other adult daughters who were living in other parts of Germany and experiencing the revolution in Berlin and in Kiel. And they were, they knew lots of famous revolution. They are their own interesting story. that family needs a book written about them. But the police had seized all of their correspondence. And these letters were really just amazing. So in this case, I really had, you know, from all of these different geographic locations and generational perspectives, this sort of sense of how people were writing and acting in this revolutionary way, you know, that you would wear the reform dress and you would cut your hair in a particular way and you would feel yourself to be part of this world historical change, right? So it's not just going to a protest and the kind of more obvious politics around that, but also the body politics and the gender politics of this kind of self-presentation as a revolutionary woman and how people perceived that. And in the case of Munich also, you know, both Gabriela Ketzler, the mother in the family, and then this foster daughter, Hilda Kramer, you know, they were just they were not accused really of anything substantial. And yet the trials were in the newspapers so prominently, and they were treated with so little respect across the political gamut of newspapers, right? Mm-hmm. That they were treated as sort of silly and peripheral. Now, I don't know them. I don't know how silly they were, right? But like it was out of such a kind of stereotypical disdain for women's political activities that this sort of reportage of their trials was presented, that it made me also there want to kind of dig in and figure out, like, why? I mean, why yeah. are people so concerned with these two minor cases? And also, why, once they have become concerned, do they write about this and these women in this really derogatory way? So that, you know, particular case is one that I go into a lot in chapter 5, just because I feel like it is so revelatory. And then I tried also, you know, again, without necessarily the exact matching sources for both cities, you know, it's the comparison dilemma. I tried to then just use court cases that I found of women where, unfortunately, I didn't have that same kind of matching police file of all their correspondence, but to kind of get a little bit of a sense of that in the Hungarian case as well. And in the Hungarian case, obviously, the other source is the memoir by the right-wing woman, Cécile Tormai.
I was going to ask you about that.
Who is a very fascinating character in her own right, and she also deserves her own book, although I will not be writing it. I have read enough of her.
Could you tell our listeners who she is? I mean, I'm very, you know, fascinated by her conservatism, obviously, but
yeah,
like so how she explains away violence.
So she's an interesting figure because generationally, I mean, she is very much, of a older generation. She was already in the First World War, and in 1919, she was already a venerable figure in the sort of literary and cultural world of Hungary. She had written some well-received sort of romantic nationalist kinds of novels, kind of romanticizing the peasantry and romanticizing, which is very important for the Hungarian case, the relationship between Hungarian speaking peasants and their Hungarian speaking noble landlords. And she was, you know, friends with sort of all of the powers that be, which there, you know, redounds to her benefit in all kinds of ways. But she was somebody who was a concern. I mean, she came entirely out of these circles, but she wrote a memoir that sort of used her position in Budapest over the course of this revolutionary spring and summer of 1919 to justify beliefs which she had clearly held beforehand, which is one of sort of my main sort of conclusions in some ways about 1919, that it's a story that people at the time and historians since then have often told as being, you know, Cécile Tormai lived in Budapest through this revolutionary regime, and it created in her this disgust for Jewish internationalist revolutionaries. But she came into the whole experience with a disgust for Jews' revolutionary politics, right? So she was already, that was her perspective at the beginning of the revolution. And I mean, similarly, right, Hitler famously was in Munich in 1919. And, you know, I don't think that it's the 1919 experience that turned him in, right? So it is the you know, that the events are experienced through the framework that people already bring to them, what they already think about revolution, what they already think about the place of Jews in society, what they already think about the place of women in society. But Tormai was very interesting because she really was the most prominent female intellectual in those counter-revolutionary circles. And her memoir became quite popular, translated by various similarly anti-Semitic, anti-revolutionary political figures into English and into, you know, all kinds of languages. It has a disturbing afterlife on the internet. I mean, every time I Google her or her book, it's like a new mix of surprising and disturbing places that it appears. But it really, you know, her status as a survivor of this political ordeal means that this memoir that she wrote has been used to justify really all kinds of quite terrible politics.
And I guess, you know, Eliza, this is sort of my lead in to the bigger questions from your book. I mean, you raise so many interesting questions for future historians and the historiography that I think still should be written. I think about Tormai, just to sort of leave this off, and all of the prepossessions that she had before the war. Certainly she thought of women as, you know, dangerous and whatever, all of these other ways of describing them as politically dangerous or degenerate and that sort of thing. And it survived very much in the interwar Hungarian period. So I guess from your book, now leading into numbers about the Red and White Terror, the work of Béla Bodó and others who've been thinking about the scripting and narratives, what would you say, drawing from your chapters and into your conclusion, would be the historiographical items on the agenda? What do you think historians can draw, not just from memoirs which have been published, but maybe from police files, which haven't been quite as accessible?
So, I mean, I really feel like there is just a lot more work to be done on these smaller kind of revolutionary moments. And I think in general, I mean, over the period in which I've been working on this, which now is a really long time, there has been a lot of improvement and enrichment, particularly in the field of Hungarian history, with more social historians, more historians who are interested in figuring out some of these questions. And I, you know, I see in your list of podcasts that you have done that there's, you know, you've interviewed some of these people who have written really books about Hungary that didn't exist when I started my project. And I think that there is a lot of work being done about, Judith Horvath had just written a book about, you know, basically these Tormai kinds of people, right? These questions of sort of conservative female intellectual figures. There has been, Anita Kurumai, actually, if anyone is interested on the dirt, if you're interested on the dirt on Cecile Tormai, she has published an article about some of her, scandals around her own, around Tormai's personal life, which interestingly, I mean, the main takeaway there is that, like, neither at the time nor in really sort of nationalist perspectives in Hungary today does anyone seem to begrudge Tormai that she was a lesbian. So for all of the sort of scandals and her own really horrible writing about people, women and their sexuality. I guess I'm sort of more of an optimist in that I feel like a lot of the work is now being done. I mean, I think in the German case, there is still always this thing where anytime I've told somebody I'm working on this revolution in Munich in 1919, you know, the long shadow of the Spartacus. It's so huge. And, I find myself, on like an airplane or something saying, well, that never even took, I'm like Sheila Fitzpatrick was to me. Those revolutions didn't even succeed. I'm like, that wasn't even a revolution. It was an attempted revolution, So I do think that a more maybe less Berlin focused history of the end of the First World War, or even of the First World War. I mean, the First World War has engendered a pretty rich scholarship, and there have been a lot of people who've done sort of more local histories or used a particular non-Berlin location as the main focus for larger claims about the First World War. But I do think that these kinds of particularist claims and a kind of Bavarian nationalism maybe does still need to be taken a little more seriously. And all of this fantasy world, some of which was kind of tied to Bavarian particularism, but, this sort of maybe, reimagining Germany, basically, could we get a Habsburg on the Bavarian throne? These kind of crazy monarchist schemes that existed. And there has been some scholarship on the kind of monarchist schemes and certainly on the Habsburg attempts at restoration in Hungary. But, that imaginary is one that I feel like could also be a book, right? Like this kind of, where would this Germany, this sort of monarchist or right-wing Germany be centered, and how would it be, right? And that, I think, is a really interesting question, particularly since, even in my book, right, these stereotypes about the Prussians really shape a lot of our teaching of early 20th century Germany.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, I'm really interested in how you write the chapter on remembering the World Revolution, because the remembering in Bavaria is not always the same as Budapest, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you've got, not only Luxembourg coloring the German scenarios, you also have the SPD legacy, right? The Social Democrats in Munich. And that's a very different context if you do a compare contrast among your cities or even towns, if you get to the town level, right? With Budapest and the Horthy regime and everything that becomes, anti-communist and then anti-Semitic with the numerous clauses. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I wonder if you see that sort of line of inquiry where you're actually comparing very different political environments and yet many of the same kind of Jiddo Kommune stereotypes and anti-feminist stereotypes, not to mention homophobic stereotypes, are still shared across that political spectrum. This is more of a comment than a question.
Yeah, okay. I do. Yeah. I would say that is one of my takeaways, and that is why, in terms of thinking about the comparison and what to have in and what to have out, I feel like for me, one of the strengths of the book is that the cities are quite different, and obviously they have these very different relationships to the whole, right? Hungary was part of a whole of the Habsburg monarchy, but then exactly at the revolutionary moment becomes its own whole, whereas Munich was part of a German imperial whole, and then during the revolution tried to see what it could do otherwise, and then became a part of the Weimar whole, and then eventually the Nazi whole, which is, you know, the other thing about a difference in the historiography and even the remembering is that obviously the Nazi takeover in Germany just shapes everyone from that moment, their perspective on these 1919 events, right? That it's put into a causal, every instance of anti-Semitism is put into a narrative about Nazism, and you know, and one of the you know, arguments I make in the book is that, you know, I mean, in 1919 the counter-revolutionary right-wing anti-Semitism was so much more vehement and violent and real in the lives of Jews in Hungary than in Germany anywhere, you know. And my graduate school colleague Michael Miller has been doing a bunch of research on these 1919, you know, beginning in some ways with these kind of educational Jewish refugees who fled after the numerous clauses law, which limited Jewish enrollment in the universities in Hungary and is considered sort of the first anti-Semitic legislation of that interwar period. And he, you know, he has also been sort of looking at these communities then of these Hungarian Jews in Vienna and in Berlin, trying to also sort of look at them as these sort of historical communities. So I think that looking at them together, I guess one of the things that that does for me is that they reinforce each other, so that, and that's why I use so often throughout the book this word or phrase, Central Europe or Central Europeans, because the thing that I think about the two cities is that their experiences are atypical. In this era, they had more of this 1919 uncertainty and upheaval, but they are fairly typical in the region, right? And that, and that, you know, the kind of, particularly among those kind of writing classes, the letter writers, the diarists, that they really shared a kind of Central European, often German-speaking cultural world. Both on the left and on the right, and I think that they can, you know, be used together in that way rather than just comparing to see the differences.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned now you're turning toward life stories and also toward the East European Jewish refugee experience during and I think after the First World War. I wonder if you might say a few words to our listeners here at New Books Network about the history of political violence and how you're, again, reconsidering the 20th century, perhaps, and trying to get through sources and into these larger historical questions about Central Europe.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the story of these refugees is one that is also in this book, mostly because they became a real focus for nationalists and anti-Semites all over the region, in Budapest, in Munich, and even more so in Vienna, where the largest population of these First World War refugees had settled. And it was a group of people who tended to be called Galicians, Galicianer. They were from Galicia, but also some from Bukovina. It was essentially not by any modern international law definition of refugee, but that was the term that people mostly used. Internally displaced people from the eastern edges of the Habsburg monarchy, areas that were under Russian occupation during the First World War, or even places where the Russian army didn't reach to occupy, but the war had arrived, or there was fear of the Russians arriving. And so largely Jewish civilians fled from sort of the east of the monarchy to the west of the monarchy and to many of the big cities. So also in Prague and elsewhere, there were populations of these refugees. And at the end of the war, as your map makers were working, you know, this was one of these groups who really caused a lot of issues, because the question was, many places that had been dealing with these large populations of refugees, only some of whom had really sort of integrated into their places of refuge, wanted to, and language ranging from, you know, repatriate, deport, right, that these people should go back. But they really raised this question of to where, right? Where should they go back to? Where would they be obviously citizens of in this new world of nation states? Could they even go back to the places that they had left, you know, where property had been destroyed or damaged? You know, and I was on a panel at ACES a couple of years ago with Keely Stetter Halstead, who was working on, you know, she and other people working on these kind of border areas of Poland, which obviously also were all in, it was a different uncertainty than my 1919 uncertainty, but it was similar in the sense of people were trying to write different stories, different foundational stories for these interwar states. What kind of a state is Poland? Who is a member of this Polish state? Where are the borders of this state? And those are aspects of the 1919 story in both Hungary and Germany, really, in Bavaria and in, right? And so I was very interested in these people who were sort of emblematic of that, in that they were physically displaced, but also outside of a lot of these narratives that were being created, or often were the target of those narratives that were being created. And I really, my goal is always to try and like find out, you know, what people themselves thought, not what all the newspapers were writing about them. And I had had the privilege in the 1990s of doing a series of interviews with colleagues in Germany on, and I'm going to say it as a kind of title, Holocaust survivors in Czernowitz. And some of those people who we identified and found and interviewed in this sort of life historical category of Holocaust survivor were people who also had survived all kinds of other things, right? I mean, they had lived through the whole 20th century, including a couple of the women we interviewed in our first round of interviews in Czernowitz. They had been born as subjects of the Habsburg Emperor, you know, and they had experienced the First World War, either they with their families, or certainly parts of their families had been refugees, Jewish refugees, often in Vienna at the time. And I just thought that, you know, we don't really have in the archives or in our kind of historiography this category of First World War refugees, in part because the Second World War that affected much of the same population was obviously so much more horrible. But I thought, you know, if I found these stories of the First World War by talking to, in quotes, Holocaust survivors, that there must be more of those experiences in some of these collections of life stories of Holocaust survivors that, you know, organizations like the Spielberg Foundation or the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum have collected. So I have been trying to, you know, kind of use those sources as a way of trying to uncover this. And it is in part a generational experience, obviously, but this overlapping experience of being a refugee and the way yeah. that people's the sort of experience of the First World War affected their behavior during the Second World War, their options, their thoughts, their kind of life identity. You know, if they drew conclusions about the position of Jews in the diaspora, if they drew conclusions about the Russians or the Germans as, you know, sort of stereotyped groups, or if they, you know, how they kind of wrote that story of their lives. And with my, you know, primary focus being on sort of seeing how the First World War fit into those other narratives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so interested listening to you, and we're going to be running out of time, but I love to ask Galicians questions about bureaucracy and how they remember the illogic and the injustice of bureaucracy in places like interwar Poland, because of course, you know, you have the stories of people who remain, who kind of rationalize it and then tell the story of justice. And for many people who left and who have been displaced and have faced multiple personal traumas, there's nothing logical at all about it. And that was why they left. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, I'm interested in that tension, you know, throughout the 20th century. And I think actually, you know, you're covering it in your book so well, because what seems normal, normalizatia, is actually not normal at all. And that leads me to my last 60-second question for you. If you, you know, having mentioned some other authors already, can you recommend maybe two or three that our listeners might read?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you also mentioned some of the ones that I love. So I for the exact same reasons that you said, works like, excuse me, Maureen Healy's book on Vienna during the First World War, which I almost feel like, you know, if you want the third leg of my comparison, you can read her book, at least for the wartime part of it, and some of the post-war. I mean, she also has some wonderful articles about the returning soldiers and the kind of civilizing of the soldiers through the retailoring of their uniforms into work clothes and the, you know, a lot of the gender aspects. So I do feel like that provides kind of the Vienna perspective. I do still feel very inspired by scholarship on the Soviet Union. And another person whose work really inspires me and who's a wonderful historian is Lisa Kirschenbaum. And I really love her book about the siege of Leningrad, which again is one of these kind of you know, it's this little like gemstone moment that's been kind of polished into a particular narrative. And she really tries to unpick it and see, like, not to just say, here's the monumental Soviet story of heroism and here's the, you know, the critique of that monumental story of heroism as being empty or false, but to try and understand like the real day-to-day heroism of these people who lived through this terrible experience and to get a sense of how they understood their own actions. You know, how do you get up in the morning and you know, for these incredibly brave librarians she describes,
yes.
right? Like, how do you get up in the morning and continue to go to your job at the library in these extreme circumstances? And I think, you know, from reading her book and, you know, from the people that I study, that the stories that we tell ourselves about our place in history are how we do those things. It's how people get up in the morning and do terrible things. It's how people get up in the morning and do heroic things. It's how that you see yourself fitting into the big picture is, you know, life narrative, autobiography is everything, I guess.
Yes.
You know?
I think Eliza, actually, that's like the perfect place to stop. It's also the mantra for a department chair, how we get up and do terrible things every day.
Right, exactly.
So, thank you so much for joining me here in conversation on New Books Network. We have been joined today by historian Eliza Oblavatsky, and I want to plug her book here. The book is called Revolution and Political Violence in Central Europe, The Deluge of 1919, just out, published by Cambridge University Press 2021. Congratulations, Eliza. And again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
And I'm your host here at New Books Network, Stephen Siegel. Until next time.